Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 5. This week, hundreds of Fortune 500 companies are evaluating Windows Phone, lots of announcements from this year's Tech Ed, and we talk about ASP.NET vNext. Hello, Carl. What a beautiful day for a podcast, huh?
It is beautiful today, even in Wisconsin.
Yeah, the weather is finally getting good out here. It's a nice sunny day, and we got to be stuck inside doing the podcast, but happy to do it.
Absolutely.
So, for anybody who's been following the Twitter feed, we've been working on getting new stickers printed up. So we have stickers that say MS Dev Show, and we got this new arcade type logo. You can see a variation of that logo out on the website.
And as well as the Twitter page, we've customized with it as well.
Yep. So we're basically pushing out new branding across everything. So if anybody wants to get their hands on one of these new stickers, right now I ordered 50 of them just to make sure that the sizing was good, and I'm pretty happy with how they turned out. And if you're interested in getting one of these, and if we get a lot of requests for this, we'll have to take them out in the next batch. But if you could retweet something from the @MSDevShow Twitter account, and then just send us an email at feedback@msdevshow.com and give us your address, as long as you're a U.S. resident, just because it can be difficult sending things outside of the country in certain cases. We'll go ahead and send you out one of the new stickers. So check out the Twitter feed, and you'll see what the sticker looks like. And if you want to get your hands on one of those, and I have, there's two different designs. So what I might do is just throw both of those designs in there so that everybody has a choice in what they want. So this week, we have, let's jump into the news. So Carl, you have some mobile news for us.
Yep. This week, Windows Phone 8.1 developer preview, people who have that installed, got an update to Windows Phone 8.1. Now, they were a little bit sketchy on the exact details of what happened or what this all includes, but they did mention that it includes a lot of bug fixes and battery improvements. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have confirmed that the battery improvements are real. So sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to quantify that, but there are a slew of good battery apps out there. Mm-hmm. And people have confirmed that the battery is about what it was.
Well, it looked like some people had a real problem with battery life. Did you have any issues with yours?
I have had terrible battery problems. At first, I usually chalk it up to, you got a new phone, you're using it a lot more, you're using a lot more features. But even after that first couple of weeks went away, I was still noticing that I couldn't make it through a full day with a battery charge. Yeah, okay. And in fact, it got so bad I bought an external battery as well.
Okay.
So, the battery improvements are pretty substantial. Mm-hmm. And they said, like they said, there are some bug fixes in there as well. So it's exciting to see them making a lot bigger, quicker cadence to these updates as well, something that we haven't seen from them in the past. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was really quick. Now, I didn't experience any battery issues, so I can't really tell if it's improved or not.
Well, you also have a ginormous battery in your phone.
Yeah, I'm actually convinced that the 1520 has some kind of nuclear reactor in it, but I haven't gotten confirmation from anybody on that.
Yeah. So that pretty much covers all that we know about these updates at this time, but for those of you who have the developer preview but haven't seen these updates, go into your settings and check for updates manually. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it'll already be downloaded. You just have to activate it.
Okay. Does this one require Wi-Fi, do you know, or will this one download over cellular?
I do not know. Mine had all auto-downloaded already. Okay. So I'm assuming that all happened on Wi-Fi, but
okay. Cause I was traveling and I was not on Wi-Fi, and I think it gave me the option to download it. So I think even if you're out and about, it'll give you an option for that. Yep. Have you noticed, the podcast app in 8.1, using up a lot of data on your phone? Have you been watching that at all?
It does. I have it explicitly enabled. There is an option in there for you to flick if it can do it over Wi-Fi only or cell as well.
Right.
And there have been times I've switched it to Wi-Fi only because last month I did get pretty close to my limit.
Yeah, I think I might have to do that on mine. Mine's been burning through a lot of data because I've been traveling quite a bit.
Yeah, one of the things that people had previously complained about is the previous podcast experience was limited to checking when it felt like, which was once in the middle of the night.
Right.
Now, a lot of podcasts don't push out then. And when people find out there's a new episode, they're pretty excited. Mm-hmm. So one of the new improvements in this podcast app is it checks constantly, mm-hmm. including whenever you open the app, it'll check again.
Yeah, I heard if it sits around for a while, I think it'll go down to like every 6 hours. But the problem with, like you said, with the previous podcast app was that it would not, there was no way to force it to check. There were some tricks to go in there to get it to force it to check. But every time you open this one, it forces it. So basically, you know, while you're charging it at night, it's going to download them. And then throughout the day, as you open that and listen to podcasts, you're automatically going to get those. So yeah, I haven't been out of date with my podcast at all since I've gotten this new one.
Yeah. And in addition, you can go to an individual feed and bring up the menu, and it'll allow you to manually refresh a specific one individually as well.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yep. The next big thing that was announced this week is Microsoft said that there's hundreds of Fortune 500 companies are currently testing Windows 8.1 devices.
Wow.
Now, this is pretty big news, because if even a good portion of them start supporting Windows Phone, that's going to be a huge uptick into the usage of Windows, or the percentage share that Windows Phone is compared to what it is now. Because right now it's somewhere between, mm-hmm. 3-4%, depending upon who's measuring.
Okay. Now, are these enterprise, would you say that these enterprises typically are handing out devices to their employees? Is that how this is working?
Now, it's not saying exactly what's going on in these cases. Mm-hmm. We know that there's some corporations that do push out phones to some, and some run more of a bring your own device kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
But they said that there's a few key features that Windows Phone has that is enticing to Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm.
The management tools are one of them. There's so many more ways, so many more easy ways that the management tools can support and dictate what can be done with the phones, mm-hmm. compared to Android and iPhone.
That's pretty low hanging fruit, to be honest with you, because it I know historically with iOS at least it's been pretty terrible, and I suspect it's been the same on Android.
Yeah, one of the things that they showed in Build that I thought was pretty cool is with the VPN support on there. When you're VPN'd, the company could disable like games that it doesn't want you playing when you're supposed to be quote at work.
Okay.
So there's a lot of stuff like that that's built in that I don't know of any equivalent features on the other platforms.
Okay.
They said the other thing, which is even bigger than that reason that would entice these large companies, is the universal apps.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to write once, or at least mostly once, and get multiple devices is really attracting these larger companies. A lot of them are willing to develop the desktop app, and they want the phone app as well, but they don't want to build an entire new app.
Yeah, I wonder if these companies are starting to see things a little different, where they're sort of adding together the market share of Windows Phone and Windows 8 together, tablets, desktops, phones. You sort of add that whole market share together, and you take that, and now you start comparing that to iOS and Android, and it starts to level it out a little bit more, because it used to not be clear, right? You really had four platforms previously. You had iOS, Android. Most of these companies are already running Windows on their desktop, so they had to deal with that. And then Windows Phone was really like this other thing. So they had four categories, and the numbers, were really low for the Windows Phone portion, just statistically speaking.
Yeah, especially when you look at it. I mean, a lot of these companies are already .NET shops. They already understand C# and VB.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to keep on going with their current skill set, they don't have to really retrain a lot of employees anymore to support these paradigms, because the new Windows Phone 8.1 model is pretty much the same as the Windows Store model.
Okay.
So you don't have to retrain. You don't have to understand, well, what's the Windows Phone Silverlight version, right, nuances compared to everything else.
Right,
They literally are the same lifecycle models.
Yeah, what's interesting, whenever I talk to these partners and these various companies, anytime I start talking about BYOD, they start mentioning, there's still a lot of companies out there that dictate the device. And whenever I talk to partners and start telling them that, then they start talking BYOD. So I'm curious what the actual mix is these days. I guess there's there's obviously companies are seeing a shift over to BYOD, but I'm curious what the breakdown is right now and where that's going to be in, you know, X number of years.
Yeah. And I think that's really going to be changing too with the trend for people wanting cheaper and cheaper devices, as well as these devices becoming cheaper and cheaper. Mm-hmm. Windows Phone has a great story for really low end devices that have really good just usage. I mean, they don't feel like cheap devices. Yeah. Android has a little bit of that, and iPhone, there is no low end story to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. I was talking to somebody just this week. He had an iPhone. He ended up breaking the screen. He went out and he bought the Nokia Lumia 521. And when you start looking at the pricing, I mean, it's $600 versus $60. I mean, it's a 10th of the price. It's just amazing. And he said to me, he's like, you know what? He's like, this thing is pretty much just as good. And, you know, that's really the low end. You know, had he been using a 1520, you know, I think he would have said, hey, this thing's better than my iPhone. So for a 10th of the price being pretty much good enough, I mean, that makes it, yeah, like, you know, I think that makes it a lot easier for companies to just hand those out. And I think a lot of people are starting to look at that device saying, you know what, I have a tendency to break my device. Insurance is expensive. You know, I just can't get over the price of that device. I'm just still in awe.
Especially with all the services that are baked in. Right. I was recently working with somebody at a place that I was working at. They were having a photocopier that was being fixed, and I was working with him. And he had mentioned that he wished that he had a certain file. It was on his other phone that he had just broken. Mm-hmm. And then I had mentioned that, you know, Windows Phone has OneDrive built in, and I just keep all of my files on there so I can access them from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned to him, well, you could use Google Docs like that. And he's like, well, you got to set that up. And just because there's that little bit of stuff that you have to do, he didn't. How many people aren't going to learn to do that?
Whereas exactly.
That's just built in otherwise.
Yeah, this is going on a little bit of a tangent, but I had somebody on Facebook. They had posted kind of a comparison between Google Docs and OneDrive, and I could tell that they were trying to sort of make up their minds, you know, with these file sharing services and or these you know, document handling services. I'm not quite sure what to call them, but just because the you know, the features of them are so drastically different. But the article he posted, in that one, it sounded like, you know, Google Drive won by a little bit. And then I started chatting with him and I said, well, you know, in the newer version, you know, if you're running Windows 8.1 as an example, OneDrive is actually integrated. So now I said one of the greatest features is that you can have, let's say your computer has just throwing out numbers, 100 gigabytes of hard drive space. You can actually have 200 gigs of files in your OneDrive, which I have, I think, 240 gigs now, because you can get free space, like, you know, just by doing just about anything. It's really easy to get, you know, free space on these things.
Yeah, I got 100 gigs just by doing some Bing searches.
Yeah, exactly. It pretty much gets handed out like candy if you know where to look. And so I told him, I said that that's the beautiful part about it, because those files will show up as being on your computer, but it's intelligently cached. It's really just an intelligent cache. So the files that you use often are actually going to reside on the machine, or you can even manually go in there and say, hey, these files are important to me. Make sure that I always have them on my hard drive. And then the other ones show up as being there. And whenever you need them, it'll just pull them down dynamically and cache them. And I think that's really the killer feature versus these other ones. And I don't think it was marketed well, because it was marketed as, you know, good better OneDrive integration in Windows. But I think we could definitely tell a better story around how, you know, how useful that actually is in the, you know, real day-to-day usage.
Yeah. Now, either way, there's a lot of Fortune 500 companies are looking at what the story is with Windows Phone 8.1. And it sounds like there's a lot of potential good news coming from that front.
Okay. Yeah, there's also, you know, security implications there, right? So Windows Phone is encrypted by default, a lot of companies like that. And I know in Windows Phone 8 and I think Windows Phone 7 and sort of that lineage, the enterprise features were ignored for a long time. Other than some of the things, like I said, like the device encryption, which was baked in. I think some of those things were ignored for a while because, you know, the consumer experience was being chased. But I think what you're seeing now is the enterprise features are passing everybody else up. And really that was what I think that's what the other companies are really worried about, you know, like Apple and Android, because that's how we get in, right? That, you know, the companies want these enterprise features. That's why BlackBerry was popular for so long. And that just helps you get your foot in the door, you know, with security, and then people start to love the platform for all the other great reasons. So should we move on to Tech Ed?
Yep.
So that's really, so Tech Ed is really the big news of the week. So I put together a super post here, and we'll put it in the show notes, but I have sort of a rundown of every big announcement that I'm interested in, or I thought was kind of big news. It is developer focused. There's probably some things that are IT pro related that was announced, and I either didn't quite understand, or, you know, they just weren't, that just wasn't quite my cup of tea. So I have sort of a developer focused list of Tech Ed items out of my blog at ytechie.com. So first let's run through a list of new services. There's lots of good stuff out here, and Carl, feel free to chime in on any of these. But the first one, and I actually noticed, I noticed this one pretty early Monday morning, and people seem to be pretty excited about this. So Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 virtual machines are now available in Azure for your MSDN subscription. So again, Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 isn't licensed for use like in production. It is through a feature that we're going to talk about in a little bit, but for dev test scenarios underneath your MSDN, you can actually see these images and create them. So if you want to do some testing on Windows 7 or on Windows 8.1, I even think you could run, you know, Visual Studio or something like that on there if you have the MSDN account. I think it's all legit to use it for that.
Yeah. Now to be a little bit more clear about this too, in the past, Azure has been pretty open to running nearly whatever operating system that you wanted up there,
yep,
with the restriction that it had to be a server OS. So with this,
that's actually not technically true. So Azure was always happy to run Windows 7 and 8.1. It's Windows itself where the licensing did not allow it. So just a sort of a different variation of what you said.
Right, because I knew that you could put them up there in your own VMs, but I thought, mm-hmm, that in order, or one of the big things is that, at least in the wording that I've seen, they always mentioned server OS in regards to the VMs images that were available.
Yeah, and that, like I said, that's because of the licensing restriction in the actual Windows license. It's not an Azure license restriction; it's a Windows license restriction. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because either way, you weren't allowed to run them. But the point is now, I think there must be some kind of exception, or, you know, I don't know if there's a different type of license being used here, but again, for dev test, you're able to use those, which is nice, because, you know, I don't see a good reason to use those in production, but definitely for, you know, they work great for testing scenarios. If you just want to, you know, create some Windows 7 machines, I don't have any Windows 7 machines anymore. So being able to create those and do testing on them is pretty huge for me.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, there's a public preview of Azure Files. So this one is really interesting. So this lets you use your storage account. It's basically a layer on top of an Azure storage account that exposes it as an SMB share. So for those that aren't familiar with SMB shares, it's basically a standard Windows file share. So you can access, you know, this SMB share in a number of virtual machines. So it gives you that shared, you know, mapped storage. So this would be just like having a NAS on a local network where a whole bunch of machines can access it. And this is really designed for, you know, forklifting in applications. So this is applications that have to use a file system. You can bring those up to Azure. Now, ideally, you know, if you're developing the application, you want to hit directly against blob storage because you're going to get some advantages there. You know, anytime there's, you know, sort of a translation layer on top of something else, you're going to get a little bit of a performance impact. But this is, you know, in this case, there's not a huge performance hit. And it, like I said, it's going to work for legacy applications. But I really like the example of, you know, SQL 2014. So in SQL 2014, instead of using files in your actual database server, you can actually use blob storage as sort of your back-end store for your database. I wasn't sure if you had seen that or not, Carl.
No, I hadn't.
Yeah, so I think it's just a really good example of taking an existing application and, you know, hooking it up to a cloud-based service. And it's obviously optional. It's whenever you create the database, instead of saying, you know, put it on C/DB/my database, right? You say, I want to put it into a storage account, and here's the, you know, here's the blob name and all that type of information. And what that does is that gives you that allows the application to have a native connection to that Azure service and really take advantage of it. So this is definitely an exciting feature. And I think it's going to enable, you know, a lot of applications that, you know, this was holding back some applications. I know at least one partner I was working with, they were asking for this just because they have a third party application that has to store some files like this, and they want to make sure that it has, you know, that it's a replicated store and that it can be accessed from multiple machines. So that this one's actually pretty huge for people. Next up, partnerships with Trend Micro and Symantec to provide anti-malware solutions. So this is, you know, anti-malware for Azure. I'm not really going to dive into that one, but I know a lot of people were waiting for that one. Internal load balancing of virtual machines with private addresses. So this feature lets you, you know, previously what you would do is you would set up a cloud service and you could have a number of virtual machines or web roles behind that cloud service, and it would have a single public endpoint. And what you would do is you could set up, let's say, you know, two web servers behind that public endpoint. And as you're hitting that public endpoint, it's load balancing between those machines on the back end. A lot of people were actually jumping through some crazy hoops to use that load balancer outside of that context. They wanted to use the load balancer without a public endpoint. So that is finally supported today. Another one is multiple site-to-site virtual network connections. So this is the ability to, you know, you used to be able to have Azure sort of dial out to your local facility and talk to a router or Windows Server 2012 R2. It could VPN into your location and sort of bridge your local network with your Azure network. And what this lets you do is you can actually take, you know, if you have multiple locations, multiple facilities, it can actually VPN into multiple. That way the traffic, you know, from each of them doesn't have to, it can actually, you know, if each of those locations are trying to talk to Azure, they can just talk direct to Azure. They don't have to get routed through each other. So, you know, you're taking advantage of shorter network paths there. Cross data center virtual network connectivity. I know this one was pretty huge. A lot of people were asking for this one. So this is the ability to take multiple Azure virtual networks and have those things talk to each other. So you can actually talk, you know, between data centers. You can have, you know, even multiple virtual networks locally and have those virtual networks actually talk to each other. And that was important for applications like if you had, you know, like a Cassandra database or some other type of distributed database. And what you wanted to do was you wanted to have multiple nodes spread out between different data centers so that if there was an issue at one data center, it would, the database would actually automatically stay running at the other one. It was just sort of one big database over multiple data centers. Another feature here, IP reservation of VIP. So this is pretty cool. So this is really like Amazon's, you know, Elastic IPs, where you could, you know, Amazon has had this for a long time where you can go in there and you can say, hey, give me an IP address. And you don't even have to assign it to anything. You just say, I'd like to take an IP address by itself. And then what you can do after the fact is assign that in Azure, you can reserve that and then you can assign it to cloud services. And I think there's some other services that you can assign that to dynamically. So you can point it at one cloud service and then move it over to a different one in the future if you want. And I know if you actually compare this side by side compared to Amazon's Elastic IPs, there's some additional features. The next one is instance level IP addresses. So, you know, like I was talking about earlier, you could have a cloud service and you'd have multiple virtual machines inside of that cloud service. And a cloud service really works kind of like your network at home, right? You have your router and then you have multiple machines in your network. So you have sort of the gateway and then you have all the machines inside of your network. So you know, that works pretty good for most applications because everybody just hits that public endpoint and then just sort of gets routed to the internal machines. But what this lets you do is actually expose individual virtual machines out through that, you know, out with its own public IP address, without having to go through that cloud service endpoint. So that one is pretty huge for some people. People who wanted to, for example, have a secure outbound port, you know, think like port 443, but they had multiple nodes with different endpoint, you know, with the same endpoint that they wanted to expose. So this now lets you do that. Next one up, I found this one really fascinating. Azure Remote App. Did you want to talk about this one a little bit, Carl?
Yeah, I had a chance to play with this one a little bit at least with the client side. I'm still waiting to get the preview edition of the developer side of this. Mm-hmm. But what's really cool about this is from a user's perspective, if they need to run like some sort of work application or something, you would open up the remote app application and sign into it with your work credentials. Mm-hmm. You could use a Microsoft account too as well. And any application that has been shared out to you by IT, it would behind the scenes open up a remote desktop services and you would access that app on your machine and it would look and feel just like we're a native application, but it would be coming from the cloud. So if there was a custom application that you needed to get your job done, you would open it up. Right now, if you download that application, they're letting you use Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And it just takes a few seconds for it to make that connection and open it up. But once it is, it feels like an absolutely native app.
Yeah.
Now, what's cool about it is from the deployment side, you can either have it hosted entirely in the cloud in Azure, or you could have a hybrid approach where Azure still has to know about your app and who can have access to it, but you can have that app located on premises.
Okay.
So at least for the cloud hosted one, you upload it into the remote app section of Azure and assign it to either a user or a group through Azure Active Directory. And that person then has access to it. It's really three steps to get going. Four steps if you already don't have Azure Active Directory set up.
Okay.
So it looks very simple to implement and it works really well. I was able to play with it and tried to, you know, bog them down a bit and I had no problem using them whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah. I fired up PowerPoint because I figured that would be the most intensive of the applications just because there's, you know, huge graphics. Because my experience with these, with, you know, the remote desktop protocol is that it's dynamically figuring out what type of content it's looking at. So, you know, if you have a window that is just showing files in Explorer, as an example, I think it uses one type of compression and, you know, it looks absolutely flawless and you can kind of move a window around. And then whenever you're running, you know, something that has a photo in it, sometimes that photo will slow down because it has to use a different type of compression. So that's why I picked PowerPoint. And yeah, what I noticed was that it would, you know, sometimes with some of the larger graphics, it would just take a moment longer. But again, I think this is meant, I don't think this is meant as necessarily replacing every app on your computer. But even if, you know, I felt that that was the experience I got on that was probably the worst I would ever get. And it was still completely usable. So it was actually really impressive. I even went into presenter mode. And it used both of my monitors and I had the presenter view on one screen and the actual presentation on the other. So I was really, really impressed. And there was no way to tell that it was not a native application running on my computer.
Yeah. One of the things I'm really excited for is right now when I do work remotely, I use the Citrix to do it where it just, you know, streams in your entire desktop.
Yeah.
What's nice is you really don't need all of that extra stuff. Mm-hmm. If you can just stream the apps in that you need. And what's cool is if you need more than one, it actually shares the same remote desktop service. So you're not pulling, you know, extra resources. It really does a lot to optimize your bandwidth and your memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you could use this for something like Visual Studio and conceivably do development with this, which I think is pretty cool because I've been trying to do that for years. And, it's always been a little clunky, and then you get to deal with a remote desktop window. So, you know, this just gets rid of the issue with window management. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah. And when I went to the build where they gave out the Surface RTs, I've been waiting for a way to have some way to remotely develop that isn't a pain. Now, if we're allowed to put Visual Studio as one of these remote apps, that could be really powerful.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you have, you know, sort of a low power device that works fine for real basic consumption, you know, reading emails, sending emails. That thing will even run Office on it, and it also has, you know, a pretty decent browser, but what you can't do on it is run something really heavy like Visual Studio, nor would you want to, because, you know, Visual Studio,
it's a beast.
Yeah. It's going to drain your battery. You know, you got to deal with kind of synchronization between multiple devices. So if you could sort of share that, I mean, one of my biggest complaints with, I think Visual Studio has gotten much better with this, and distributed source control has really helped, but just the kind of the sharing of state, right? I want to be working in Visual Studio on my desktop. Then I want to go on the road. I want to show up somewhere else, and I want to fire up Visual Studio and have it be exactly where I was, you know, with access to the same files that I had. And this will enable those types of scenarios, which I think is pretty neat.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the bigger stories that enterprises will latch onto, because there's a lot of cases where you have that, you know, you want the thin client, style of giving stuff to your users. Plus, you still want that control on who gets what. Mm-hmm. There's also ways where you can have with this multiple versions of the same app, and you can say, well, this kind of person gets this version of the app, and this one gets a newer version, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot already built into it, even though this is a fairly new offering from Microsoft.
Yeah, I this has been rumored for a long time, and I think the reason that it's taken so long is those scenarios have been well thought through. At least that's what I hope. And then I don't know if you saw the tech ed video, but they were actually demoing this on an iPad. I'm not even sure if they demoed it on a computer, but they demoed it on an iPad. And there was just a button in the iPad app that let them switch between applications. And it was actually pretty, you know, it was pretty seamless. They were able to jump back and forth between some of the Office apps. And then they even had things like Notepad and Calculator from Windows. Now, it's kind of a made up example, but, you know, you could imagine Visual Studio on there. And, I guess the only issue on the iPad is the lack of a mouse, but you could conceivably be writing code, you know, with your keyboard in Visual Studio on an iPad.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Anything else on the remote app? Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Okay, so next up from TechEd, there's a public preview now of API management. And this one's pretty exciting. So if you recall, there was a company that Microsoft bought, I don't know if it was a year ago, maybe a little bit more than a year ago. It was called Epiphany. And what they did was API management. So it was just sort of a matter of time before this reappeared. So, API management, if you're not familiar with it, gets you things like analytics. You can do throttling on web services so that if somebody's just hitting a service too much, a particular API, you can start to slow them down or just restrict access for a while. You can also do things like caching so that if somebody, you know, if you designate certain method calls with certain parameters, you can actually have that be cached outside of your application, which I think is pretty neat. And then this thing comes with a whole bunch of, you know, it's basically a permission-based system so that you're setting up different types of users. So you can have, you know, public and unauthenticated users, but then you could have other users that you're able to identify in different buckets that maybe have paid for your API. And they could be, you know, subjected to different throttling, or not throttling limits, but they could have, you know, they could be allowed a different number of API calls. So as an example, the general public, you could allow them to make 5 API calls per minute. And if you're, you know, in a certain tier of application or of a customer, you could make, you know, 100 calls per minute. And then you could have another tier where it's unlimited. So it's kind of neat. It doesn't add a whole lot of latency to your APIs. So it's worth it to put this on top of it for a lot of these benefits that you get. And I think if you can utilize something like caching, that's pretty huge, because you could actually, even though you're slowing down all of your calls by, you know, let's say 10 milliseconds or so, you are, you know, through the use of caching of maybe some of these heavier calls, you could actually have a net positive benefit where overall the calls to your API actually take, you know, less time. And then the analytics are really nice, where you can actually do all the tracking of that and see who's hitting your API, what kind of performance they're seeing. It shows you the performance between them and between the customer and the API, and then also the API management and the backend API. So you can start to figure out where your bottlenecks are and figure out where performance issues are. So it's pretty full featured. It's pretty impressive. So that's in public preview right now. Also in public preview now, we support the Redis cache. So you can go out and create one of these and use this instead of the other caching option. So this is in addition to the new managed cache option that came out, I think, a few months ago. So the old shared caching service is going to end up being retired in September, but customers should have, you know, switched over to the managed cache or switch over to Redis. Both of those are pretty good options. And for a lot of people, it's actually pretty easy to swap out your cache. So this is for, you know, if you're running an ASP.NET application and you're using the built-in cache functionality, it's actually pretty easy to swap in a different cache provider as long as they have, you know, as long as they fit into the provider model. So it should be, you know, fairly easy, even if you're on the old caching service, to swap in this new one and then just use that standard, you know, cache interface that's provided from ASP.NET. And Redis also is really good for, you know, other types of applications. So if you have like a Java application or any other type of language, this is pretty universal out there. So this is just, you know, a sort of a generic caching service that a lot of applications are going to be able to tie into. Next one is, they're in public preview now, or the BizTalk hybrid connections. So I actually talked to the folks that came up with this one, and I was hoping that this one would have a different name. I was hoping it would not be under the BizTalk title, just because BizTalk has, you know, I think it just has a certain reputation with people. And so what this is, this lets you, this is pretty neat. You can use it by itself as well. So what this lets you do is communicate with existing services. So you can actually have a website set up, and let's say it needs to talk to a local database that's, you know, still installed, you know, on premises. What you can do, instead of setting up a VPN connection, you can actually install an agent next to that database, which will make an outbound connection. And it will, you know, it will piggyback over that connection to talk to that database. Does my audio sound okay, Carl?
Hey, you're starting to break up just a little bit.
Let me change something real quick. There, is that better?
Yeah.
I'll just leave that portion turned off. So up next, now you have the ability to capture images in Azure of virtual machines with your operating system and the data drives attached. So previously, whenever you took an image of a machine, it was just the machine itself. It wouldn't take an image of all the drives that were attached. So this now lets you basically capture a snapshot of the whole thing. So a lot of people were asking for that type of functionality.
It's also pretty interesting that it also works on stop machines as well. I think that's pretty powerful.
Well, so the other one always worked on the stop machines. This works on the running machines too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you were actually forced, my understanding, well, there was a way to get around it, but in many cases you actually had to stop the machine to take an image. This one you can actually do while it's running. The challenge here is getting a consistent image, since it could be running and there's things in memory. And so I haven't played around with this yet. I'm anxious to play around with it to see, you know, what the official guidance is going to be as far as, you know, are you able to use this for some type of backup capability, or is this really just for dev tests, being able to roll back to previous, previous spots? I suspect that's really the key scenario there. Next up, this one is actually pretty huge for anybody who has an enterprise agreement. So previously, whenever you had an enterprise agreement for your Azure subscription, you get a discount on an enterprise agreement, and it's based on the size of the agreement. And whenever you were in an Azure subscription under an enterprise agreement, and you would try to, you know, use something out of the Azure store. So let's say it was like SendGrid or, I can't even think of the other ones that are in there. There's some database options in there. ClearDB, I think, is one of them as an example. you weren't able to use those, it would just pop up a message saying, hey, you can't do this because the subscription belongs to an EA account. And it was because of the discounting on there. So now there's actually store support for the EA customers. So now, you know, any EA customer that goes in there and tries to use something out of that store is not going to have an issue anymore. So I think, you know, for a small group of people, that's actually pretty huge. And then the last one here, and I figure you might have a comment on this one. There was a big update to the Windows 8 store. Did you see this one?
Yeah, I saw the announcement. I actually, however, have not actually gone into the store since this has been updated.
Okay. Yeah, I have a link to, you know, Paul Thurrott. He kind of did a walkthrough of it. So on this tech ed post, I have a link to that so that you can check out the screenshots. So obviously you could just go do it on your device too and take a look at it. But it sounds like it was a pretty massive cleanup and reorganization of what the front end of that store looks like.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this because, one, it was pretty hard to find explicit things that you were looking for in the store. Even if you knew exactly what you're looking for, a lot of times it can be hard to find that.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really nice is now that you have apps that can be on the Windows Store and the Windows Phone Store, it allows you to access the other version a little bit more easily now. So once you go into the store on Windows here, if there's a phone version, there's a UI element you can click on and it'll take you right to the Windows Phone Store so you can check it out there as well.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty nice. That's really nice. I didn't even think through that scenario. You know, I usually just jump over to my phone, but if that's in there, that's pretty slick.
Yeah. In this case, it's called a linked app. So you can link to another one of your apps.
Okay.
And one of the things that you can do with this is if you pay for one, you can allow for the other one to be free with this feature.
Okay. That's pretty neat. And then up next, so at TechEd, so I talked about a lot of the new services, and a lot of those are in preview. You know, they're in public preview, so you can go check out some of those. Some of those require you to go in and actually request access to the preview. But this next one, so this next group is actually services now that have been out, but they've just gone general availability, and there were, you know, some various other changes here. So one of them is the A8 and A9 machines, and those are available now on the for the virtual machines. So they were originally just PaaS options, so they were really for the HPC, the big data type scenarios, and now those are opened up for standard virtual machines as well, and those are GA. So an A8 gives you 8 cores and 56 gigs of RAM. A9 gives you 16 cores and 112 gigs of RAM. And the other nice thing about these are actually Intel processors. So what that gives you is this InfiniBand network. So it gives you this super high performance, low latency InfiniBand network. And honestly, I haven't worked with any applications that require this, but there's some applications that are able to take advantage of that high speed network. Another service that went GA is the Azure Import Export. So this is one where you can actually BitLock or protect a hard drive and then send it into Azure, you know, so that you don't have to upload a whole bunch of files. They'll hook it up, and then you go into the console and you put in your BitLocker key, and it will give you access to that machine. And then last of the services that went GA, Azure Cache Service. So this is the managed cache service. So this is one that will... This is a super high performance, you know, cache service that's built right on top of Azure. And then in the next section here, so we have Visual Studio updates. There were a lot of neat updates here. So one of the big ones was Visual Studio 2013 Update 2 just went RTM. So you can go grab that. Again, we'll have a link to that off of my blog post. And you'll be able to find that blog post in the show notes. But if you go and download that, install it. I've already installed it on my machines. It's got some interesting things. So there's a post that Scott Hanselman did, and he kind of did a walkthrough. So for a detailed walkthrough, I'd recommend going out to his site. But some interesting things about it. It is cloud and server optimized. So there's actually some specific optimizations there for when it's running on the cloud and whenever it's running on the server. So I think there's been a lot of pieces that have been trimmed out and a lot of things that have been rewritten that are specifically designed for increasing performance in this cloud environment. There's also a no compile developer experience. And I know we talked about this one before the show, Carl. So this one lets you, you know, have an ASP.NET website where you put some code in there and without it compiling, you can actually go and browse it. So this is similar to like how PHP and Node.js work.
So you just, when you're developing, you just refresh your browser and exactly. then you get all the updates without yep. having to compile. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember previously one way that we would kind of get around some of that is you'd still have to build, but you'd set up IIS fully locally, just like you would on the server. And then you were able to refresh, but you still had to build,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this cuts that down even further, because a lot of times when you get bigger enterprise applications, I mean, you can have, you know, several minutes to build if it's pretty substantial.
Right. And anytime you can just help developers iterate faster and faster, you know, where you make a code change and you can see that immediately, that's always a huge, huge advantage.
And it also reduces the, you know, setup time of your development environment as well, because if you don't have to go through all of those workarounds, that's
mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This was interesting too. So the entire runtime now is going to be available through NuGet. So, and this is pretty cool for ASP.NET. So a lot of things were, you know, the things that we're talking here around ASP.NET, these are all in, you know, sort of a future version of ASP.NET. And so what you'll be able to do with the actual .NET runtime is grab that through a NuGet package. So your application can actually have a dependency on a particular version of .NET, and you can pull .NET in with it. So that one is really interesting. So you could have, you know, two different applications on your machine, both using a different version of .NET, and that version of .NET is actually isolated to that folder, you know, to that application itself. So that one I find really fascinating. So you can sort of do that today with things like Node.js, where you actually put the executable in the folder and you get that version of Node.js along with it. And that's pretty handy in many cases, because that's really what that gives you is that it gives you that bin copy deployment option. So for all of the things in ASP.NET vNext, the source is actually all available out on GitHub. This is all open source, and you can actually go out there and look at it today. So again, we'll have a link to that one. But you can go out there and start, you know, giving feedback on what they're working on, which I think is pretty neat. And then in Visual Studio, one thing that was announced was tooling support for Cordova. So what this lets you do is, you know, the Cordova is a platform. It's like a phone gap where you can build cross-platform HTML and JavaScript applications. But now there's tooling support built right into Visual Studio, which makes this a lot easier. So that was pretty much it for TechEd updates. It was, you know, that was sort of the giant high level list. And again, I have links to let you drill into any of those specifically that you're interested in, but we wanted to just give you an update of anything that we thought would affect, you know, the developer experience.
Yeah. There was a lot of big things, especially around Azure. I mean, they have an amazing cadence the way it was, but there were some really big bombs. I don't think anybody predicted the ASP.NET vNext stuff that came out.
Yeah, that one came as a surprise to me too. I actually hadn't heard anything about that. I don't follow, you know, ASP.NET you know, itself very closely, but it's really neat to see a lot of activity in that space. I think you know, I'm gonna have to start watching that a little bit closer. I didn't expect such a kind of a core change in how they're building and designing everything. I think that's really exciting.
I really think a lot of what they have done over the last quite a few years even has really permeated how the rest of the company is starting to look at things, with how progressive they've been with going to open source and just be developer accessible in those areas.
Definitely. So, you know, somebody had to do it first, but now, yeah, like you said, that opens up the gates for everybody else. So very, very interesting. So Carl, what do you got for the app of the week?
So previously on Windows Phone 8 and Windows Phone 7, there was the ability that you could go and share something. One of the options was social networks. And with just that quick couple of taps, you could share something out to Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn mm-hmm. all at once at the exact same time. Well, in 8.1, that's gone now. And it's really upset quite a few people. But this week's app of the week is something to replace that. So there will be a link in the show notes, but it's called Multi-Social Share. It's okay. Also happens to be a universal app, so it's available for Windows store as well as the phone. So when you hit the share option now, you can just select multi-social share. And when you first download the app, you'll set up all of your social networks, and including what your default is. So if you want to set up Facebook but not necessarily have that be there by default, you can do that.
Oh, this looks pretty nice. It looks, it's really simple, but it looks like it's, you know, it's pretty slick.
It is. And it gives you back that functionality that was lost. And it also, I believe, either supports or will support additional social networks other than those three that were there.
Okay.
So anybody who's missing out on that, go and download multi-social share. And a really quick way to get all of your social networks at once.
So when I'm in Windows 8 and I actually hit the share button, so this will just show up in that list. I pick that and then it will give me options on which ones to share it with.
Yep. It'll have you type in your message. And then if you want to select additional ones or remove a few, it's a really quick interface to do that.
That's nice. That's nice. I didn't even realize that was in Windows 8 and got removed. I would have used that if I would have known it was there.
Yep.
Okay. I think that's anything else, Carl? I think that's all we have for this week. TechEd was the biggest thing.
Yeah, it's good to get that rundown.
Yep, definitely. So let's talk about some plugs for the show. So you can find us at msdevshow.com. You can send us feedback at feedback@msdevshow.com. And like I mentioned earlier, if you want a sticker, go ahead and retweet something that we tweeted out from the MS Dev Show account, and then send us an email with a link to that tweet, and we'll make sure that you get a sticker. Once we get the big batch of them in, we'll make sure that you get, at least one of the, one of each design. So make sure that you do that. So I'm Jason Young. You can find me on ytechie.com. On Twitter, you can find me at ytechie. That's twitter.com/ytechie. That's ytechie. And now one thing I did want to mention is that I will be speaking at the IoT World in, it's in Palo Alto, and that's in, mid-June. So that'll be interesting. I'll be on a panel actually talking about industry and the Internet of Things, you know, this whole boom that's going on right now. So that should be some interesting discussion. So if anybody is in the area there, send me a message. Might be able to meet up. Otherwise, go to IoT World and hear me talk about IoT and industry. Carl?
Yep. You can find me at Carl Schweitzer on Twitter or at wpdevguy.com.